So meanwhile, you guys could just start talking. Lisa's on, and Hamlet and Victoria. And
great.
Yeah, I'll hopefully be right back with John.
Thank you.
Okay.
So were the two of you on the discussion last Friday?
I was not on the discussion last Friday. But was anybody else on?
Yeah, this is Lisa. I was on.
Okay.
So could you give us a bit of a sense? I was really sorry to have missed that, but apparently you were talking about practice. Is that right?
Yeah, we were all just kind of sharing about where we were at, and one of the gals was sharing about feeling kind of a sense of overwhelmed with having to do this, and the other thing. And we kind of talked about that pusher voice inside and the how that kind of can get, you know, super involved when we're working our practice to the point where it becomes a chore. Yeah, so we were just sort of sharing, like, where we were at with our practice and what was going on with us.
Great.
Cool.
I'm sorry,
it was awesome.
That.
And Guy just gave us some great insight into, how that whole thing works. And it was really cool.
Anything in particular, Lisa, that you could share? Because I know in the past, Guy has said,
I'm echoing.
Yeah, I can hear that. I don't know what causes that. That happens to me, too.
I don't hear an echo.
Oh, I can. Now, let's see if it's still there. No. Strange. But anyway, I know Guy was, at least from what I understood from him, put a little less emphasis on formal practice and more just kind of incorporating all of it into living. Was that your sense from him?
No, not really. I didn't see it as mutually exclusive at all. What I got him saying was that in early stages, the things that we do for our practice sometimes just don't feel like fun. They feel like work. But after a while, if our doing it is informed by us kind of going unconscious and relating to it from an inner pusher that says you need to do more, you need to, you know, those absolute voices that are shaming and blaming and pushing and criticizing, that the practice then becomes detrimental because it's not being done from a place of joy at all. So he was just pointing out to become aware of when the practice seems difficult, it doesn't necessarily mean do more. That's not, you know, the message. He was trying to say that that's not really what John is saying when he says that. It's about what place you do it from. Do you do it from a voice that's very critical and, like, that inner pusher, I forget what he called it, but in voice dialogue, it's the pusher and the critic, and how they can, you know, get into a war. And if we aren't stepping back in a kind of a witness state to watch that happening, then our practice can become a drudgery. And he said the importance isn't so much practice as where we're doing the practice from. And I'm totally paraphrasing here, so I don't want to speak
for him.
That's
helpful, though. Thank you.
But that
Hi,
would
everybody.
Be great. Hi, is that Hello. John?
Yeah, sorry, guys. We're having a perfect storm. I brought everybody back to Salt Lake. I'm in a parking lot, and the phone wouldn't hook up. My Wi-Fi thing would not. Anyway, I'm here on the phone now. So will you guys want to catch me up? What's going on?
It's kind of interesting. It's Heidi. I'll catch you up real quick. So, John, we've got Julie and Lisa and Hamlet and Victoria all here. And last Friday, you know, Guy was talking about practice with Lisa and Julie, and some, you know, it was really very interesting. And so Lisa was just catching people up a little bit about what Guy was saying. So that's where we're at. We're talking about practice, and Guy was talking a lot about you know, it's good if practice is really something you like. You know, you don't want to do a practice that really is uncomfortable and not fun at all. You know, you want to do practices that resonate with you. And so anyway, so you guys can carry on.
Well, okay. Who is, was somebody talking about that?
Lisa, you were. You can.
Yeah, we just talked last week and had a really helpful conversation about how the inner critic and the inner pusher voices can take, kind of hijack our practice and make it a drudgery, and that, you know, early on, certainly things can be like, I don't want to do this exercise. I don't want to do this meditation. But sooner or later, you know, we take it on. It becomes part of our life, and it's just integrated as a beautiful part of our life. If it's not, it's you know, there's days that we don't want to do it. But he was saying, like, if it's really hard and really horrible, it could be that it's being informed more by the inner pusher, inner critic voice, and that we enmeshed with that as opposed to witnessing those inner dialogues, making the practice feel like something. If we miss one day, oh my God, we're going to relapse type fear-based inner dialogue. It was just really helpful.
I love that we're having this topic today because, you know, last night I was reading Mastery by George Leonard, which is one of the required books in the course, and I became very conscious of this pattern where it seems like I'm always looking forward to the next, you know, my days are so long that I'm always looking forward to the next break when I can take a short nap, or the next task that I have to accomplish, the next thing. And it's always like there's an end in sight, but really there's no ending in sight to any of this. So I'm always like on this rat race, and it becomes exhausting. And I realized for the first time, you know, last night, I'm like, it brought to mind, am I enjoying this process, this life living recovery process? Am I enjoying it, or am I always looking for a prize in the end, you know?
Yeah, we really talked a lot about how there's this core belief that there's something wrong with us. So we get on the fix-it bandwagon. And if I do this one more thing, that'll fix me enough, then I'll be happy. Then I'll do this one more thing, and it'll fix me, and then I'll be happy. And we never get there. So that's funny you mentioned that, because that sounds sort of like a lot of what we were talking about with the fixer voice and the, you know, working with the pusher. The fixer says you're screwed up, and the pusher says do more.
Mm-hmm.
And the fixer says you're screwed up, and the pusher says do more. Mm-hmm. And pretty soon we find ourselves going, this really sucks.
Mm-hmm.
And we kind of talked about how the realization hit that it wasn't what we were doing that was the problem. It was the space from which we were doing it from, or the identity that was running the show. Those two fixer pusher, that bonding pattern between those two voices. It sounds a lot like, I wish you had been there. You would have loved it, because it sounds exactly like what you're talking about.
So what is a centered place to practice from?
What is a what, John? What was your question?
What is a centered place to practice from? Not the boy or boy. Not the fixer boy. What is the place we practice from?
Well, I would say the aware ego or the witness state.
Mm-hmm. But in the beginning, most people aren't really in touch with that. You know,
no, in the beginning, no.
Yeah, the problem is to get to that state, it takes practice. So how does one start practice when it's really difficult and one's not comfortable with it? And how do you, where do you do that from?
Tell us, John.
Go ahead.
Well, I just had read something that I shared with them that it happened that day, and I called it, I don't like this yet. because I was doing something, and because I didn't like it, I thought, well, that's a problem. I shouldn't, you know, it's bad if I don't like it, or there's something wrong with me if I don't like it. And so what I did was I asked myself the question, I should like this. Is that true? And I found, no, it's not. I don't like it right now. But isn't it awesome I'm doing it anyway? And that completely shifted my attitude. It was like, I don't like it, and I'm doing it anyway because I care about something bigger than this discomfort right now. And so it shifted me completely into a sense of being really proud of myself. And so then I noticed the next day when I went for my run, it didn't feel like a chore. It sort of felt like, oh, now I get another chance to do it anyway because I trust this process. And it felt empowering. So it sort of shifted experience.
But you forced yourself to do it, right? So there was the push.
At this point, yeah, until it becomes a, like, and I'm finding more and more it's something I really look forward to, but I'm kind of early in the process still. So it hasn't yet, everything I do hasn't yet become something I can't wait to do.
Right.
More and more as the year has gone by, there's days where I just can't wait to get out there and run. So it's, you know, but it doesn't all feel like a chore all the time. If I let those voices take over, it does. So writing about it.
Go ahead.
No, I just said writing about it helped me get some clarity.
Yeah, I would say that most practices, whether you're, you know, you want to learn how to play the guitar or type or, you know, whatever it might be, or drive a car, you know, and at first it's not really very comfortable because in the beginning you suck, you know. It's like there's no way to get to be a master guitar player if you're not willing to go through the stage of, I really suck, you know, I'm not good. I can barely form, you know, a three-string chord. And it hurts my fingers, and I'm not right, and the strings aren't resonating, and it's just disastrous, you know. I mean, that's just the way it goes. And of course, there's probably a part of us in early recovery that's a very nourished, very strong addict voice that's been trying to kill us for a long time. That's pretty well developed because you've been feeding it, you know, for years. If you're, you know, a late progression addict. That will try to get you to do anything but practice, because practice is a direct threat to what it really wants to do, is get high and stay high. So in the beginning, it's very difficult. And just because something is difficult doesn't mean it's not worth doing. In fact, most things that are worth doing are difficult and take, you know, great effort. And that's why the role of the integral coach, therapist, someone that's, you know, an advanced practitioner that's been doing it for a long time is really important, because you know all of the, you know all the foibles, you know how your mind tries to make excuses and rationalizes not doing it and this. And so it's really, really, in my work with my students when we were doing residential, and currently as I'm doing, you know, internet coaching, it's like, you know, just to push people through it. Until they get to the point where the practice becomes something that's, you know, just very essential in their lives, and they realize it, you know. But in the beginning, it's like, you know, that morphogenetic personal field is not established yet. You know, they said when they were first trying to make, Rupert Sheldrake talked about this, when you're first doing a chemical compound that's never been done before, those molecules just don't get it, and they don't want to do that, you know. And it's like when they were first making LSD, it was a completely new compound, and about two or three people could do it in the world, and it just didn't want to happen. And after a while, it seemed like the molecules kind of learned what they're supposed to be doing, and it became pretty easy. So it's actually the physical molecular world functions like this too. There's an initial resistance, and we just have to realize that when you're in a static place, it takes a lot of effort to get momentum going. And, you know, there's going to be mental baggage. There's going to be all kinds of reasons. You're not used to it. You're not in good shape. You don't really understand it. And that's why it's really, unless you just have this intense drive like some of us get, you know, it's like when I was teaching people to play guitar, I mean, I could tell who was going to be a good guitar player because they had the eye of the tiger. I mean, they were just, the hell with it, I'm going to get this done, you know, and they put in the time and they put in the hours and they put in the effort. But yeah, there's all kinds of resistances. And just because it's difficult, that's just kind of an affirmation that it's worth doing. So whatever, you know, you have to do to get you to the party, so to speak, to establish mastery, as Hamlet was saying, you have to do that. And whether you need, like a workout partner to work with you, that often helps people a lot. We push each other, or a meditation partner. I had a client I was working with in Australia suffering with depression, and he just could never get the meditation thing established. And finally, he got himself a partner someplace that, you know, lived on some other part of the planet, and they would just get on Skype and meditate together. And he said, you know, everything started shifting. You know, I had a way to get me there. And now, yeah, everything you're saying about, you know, I'm just, you know, my job is going better, my creativity as a musician, and, you know, the depression is lifting, et cetera. So that's it's a really good question. I mean, how do we get ourselves in the early stages to do this when all the momentum of our lives has been, you know, to live in a different way? Or in the case of, you know, alcohol and addiction, to do drugs. And so it's that first part of the integral recovery process. It's really, really difficult because you're doing new behaviors and you're not doing things that were really comfortable or really the norm for your life before. So, Hamlet, can you talk about that? I mean, you're a coach. You get, you know, you work with people, in the gym. How do you work with that? Resistance.
I think it's important to establish a routine that doesn't change at first.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So set a time, you know, it's not, well, tomorrow, let's see at what time we're going to train. No, let's set a time. This is the schedule. This is how it is. And think if you're starting something out like exercise, you know, I thrive on routine, and I think it's important to establish a routine for certain things. So maybe leave your shoes out by the door if you're going to go running. Set it on your calendar. Tomorrow I'm going to do – I mean, I think we have a greater chance of succeeding or doing something if you actually, like, write it down. I know that for me, when I've gone to sleep, when I have early workouts with friends, not clients, but with friends scheduled for, let's say, a Sunday at 6 a.m. or 7 a.m. wake-up time, and I go to sleep the night before saying, I'll see how I feel when the alarm clock rings. The chances of me getting up are very, very slim at that point. But if I go to sleep with a mindset of this is what I'm going to do and I leave my clothes out, I get up. And I think it's important to establish that sort of routine, especially with exercise, when you're just starting out, where it's just set in stone. I had a client tell me yesterday, he goes, I'm used to this already. He goes, I know that Monday, Wednesday, Friday, this is what I do. And I said, yeah, you know, and I was thinking, well, that's why it's a routine. That's why it's the same time at the same time, you know, same days, doesn't change, and it becomes a habit. It becomes ingrained, you know?
Yeah. You know, I think you're making a real good point, Hamlet. I've had clients tell me this, and I'm sure I've recommended it, that, you know, when you're getting a meditation practice going, for example, if the night before, you know, you select the tracks that you're going to use and you have your cushion set up and you have your little altar and your headphones ready, just doing that the night before really reinforces the necessary practice. And so when you get up in the morning, you already have this positive message. Oh, it's all set up. This is what I'm going to do. And I do think, that getting into a schedule is very important. When we were doing residential work with clients or students, one of the things I teach is, you know, that addiction is very chaotic. You know, it's just, you know, it's this craziness all the time. You know, it's like the deal goes bad. You go, you know, your friend's house, and he gets in a fight with his wife because they're both inebriated or stoned, and it's just, you know, and in some cases, just the chaos becomes an addiction. Not just the drugs, it's all just constantly, you know, having your adrenaline pumping because of the craziness you're living. And in sobriety, especially in the early days, I think just in general, the structure is just saying, this is my practice time, this is my work time, is really, really useful. And, you know, I'm called to travel a lot, and I really try to stick to it, you know, even when I'm traveling, because I don't want to ask people to do things that I'm not able or willing to do myself. It's, you know, kind of hypocritical. So I'm off in Salt Lake now, and, you know, the first thing I did is, like, you know, I'm pretty tired because we were meeting all weekend, and then I drove 1,650 miles to come home from Texas, and then I was taking care of my aging parents for almost 3 months, you know, 24/7. And I'm like, holy crap, you know, I've got a lot of stuff to do this week. So first thing I did was just, you know, I stumbled upstairs. I was staying with friends. She handed me a cup of coffee, and I went on the couch, and I meditated for an hour. You know, it was just like, got to do it. I cannot show up in the world in the way I need to if I don't put self-care first. And it's, you know, and so anyway, there's just a doggedness about practice now. And if you can have friends that support that, just as when we're, you know, we're doing drugs and, you know, or drinking or something, we tend to want to hang out with people who are doing that also, because we actually have something to share or something in common. We don't want to hang out with a bunch of sober people. I mean, you know, what is there to talk about? And, for example, my friend Robert McNamara, whenever we go to like an integral conference, when we greet each other, it's like, hey man, where's the gym? Oh, here it is. And as soon as there's like any kind of break, both of us are just running over there, and we have a great time working out. You know, we just take our practices with us. So
that's very inspiring, John. But do you feel a sense of guilt if you don't? In other words, going back to the beginning of the, you know, what we were talking about, sometimes I'll miss, occasionally I'll miss a morning.
Yeah.
You know, of meditation, and I feel, I don't know if the guilt that I feel for having slept in those extra 30 minutes that I dedicate to my morning routine of sitting in silence, the guilt of not doing that is healthy, or if the guilt of not doing that causes stress that really is unhealthy. Like, just get over it. This is, you're not backsliding because you missed a day. How do you feel about that?
Yeah, I have little games that I've set with myself. In other words, if I miss a day, which happens, or, you know, because you can't control the exterior world and you can't always control your health. You know, you might get ill. Like I spent a couple of months ago, or however long ago, 6 weeks ago, I was in emergency rooms. I mean, 4 or 5 days being run around in ambulances and stuff. So it was really hard for me to get to the gym. However, I did, as there were ambulances pulling up and I was staggering, I grabbed an iPod and earbuds, you know. That's sort of practitioner. And I just like, okay, no excuse, I'm taking it with me. But I find that, you know, when those emergencies do come up, you know, the house is burning down and you have to get the children out, you know, and there's all this stuff. You can't, in other words, you can't sit down and meditate. It's the just a rigorous dedication to practice that I've had over the years. That's when it really comes into play. It's like, oh, I can deal with this stress. I can deal with this illness. The witness is there. I'm kind of at peace, though I'm in this chaotic thing. I mean, all my years of practice really, really helped out when I got really, really ill. I didn't know if I was going to die or not, and I was kind of okay. You know, if this is it, that's okay, you know. So what I've done, if I miss a day, then I do time and a half next day, or 2 hours the next day instead of an hour. And that is kind of just, all right. Then I evaluate at the end of the month. I usually have, you know, on an average of 40 hours of meditation, and not just 30 an hour a day, because whenever I can do extra, I do extra. Like, oh, today I don't have so much going on, so I will, you know, I'll do a little extra. So that's the way I have played it. And the reason that, you know, I think I've just been so dedicated to it, well, one of the reasons is because I suffered so bad. The horror of my depression and just living in this point of, you know, in the state of total isolation and total grief and total despair and wanting to kill myself all the time, you know, and when you're at that degree of depression, you know, death is not something to be feared anymore. It's like, bring it on, not existence. That would be great. So that's really helped me. And the other thing that really helped me is I teach this stuff. You know, and it's like, I when I was a young man, I was in a kind of a toxic religious organization. It got very toxic. And I really learned about, you know, unhealthy, you know, systems are like, what cults are like, what are some of the things. And so it became very important to me that I would actually you know, do what I teach. And I'm not just, oh, it's about you sick people and, you know, I'm just cruising here. So those are two of my, my motivations. And also I notice that when I don't practice, even in a 24-hour period, all the impressions and all the stuff that builds up, just kind of, I start, you know, kind of getting back into my trance-like state, just letting emotions and this and that. So, I mean, one of the things about meditation, it's a process of gentle process sometimes, and sometimes very sudden process of waking up. But then once you wake up, you have to stay awake, you know, because these awakened states are states. And what practice does, it stabilizes these awarenesses. So at first you get little hits of it, but the more you keep going back and to the practice, to the well, you really stabilize that awareness, and it becomes not just, oh, you know, like, dude, I did shrooms in Oaxaca in 68, you know, I really found God. It's like, okay, that was 1968. What's going on today? So practice is the way we really stabilize our witness state, our spiritual, you know, progress. And which is, you know, part and parcel of the whole, you know, the integral recovery thing that we're doing. Questions, comments?
Yeah, I'll just comment. I just know that if on a sustained level, the way that I am motivating myself is through a voice of guilt, it will not last. And that's based on my type. I take my type very seriously.
What
type?
No,
my type's, what is the word? Like, I know what motivates my type and what doesn't. And as a 7, if I have a lot of guilt self-talk motivating me, and I have a lot of words like rigorous motivating me, it's not going to last. So I'm not talking about not doing it. I just have to be very conscious of the voices that I'm doing it from. And,
so how would you?
You know, like, I've been more committed to my exercise program than I've been in my whole life in the last year. And I haven't had to guilt myself into it to do it.
Okay. So So as a 7, and as a person that might work with 7s in the future, how would you motivate a 7 to do what they need to do?
Well, first I'd ask them if they're feeling resistance to it, what they're believing about it.
Mm-hmm.
And then also help them find what's true about what's fun about it. What are the payoffs? Mm-hmm. What do you like about it?
Absolutely.
And that's a currency 7s really dig.
They do.
What makes us joyful? So when I found myself the other day with this pusher voice, not the kind of pusher voice you're talking about, John, that's like the coach. I love that voice. That's the voice I shifted into from a critical pusher going, you should enjoy this. Anybody else would enjoy it. You're out in nature. You're so lucky you get to do this. Why are you complaining? That voice will sabotage me every time if I believe it. And so it was like, what is this voice? Like, for me, staying really aware of what voices are running the show is critical for my motivation. And what I found was when I looked at what's really true for me about this, I actually feel better. I love it. I took an inventory of what makes me happy about running.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of shifted it. 'Cause I just, like, sometimes it just has to be, do it anyway. Just get up, do it anyway, damn it, and I need a kick in the ass. But there's a coach voice that's very underdeveloped in me. See, you have that coach voice. I don't. I didn't grow up in a family of encouragers. I grew up in a family of discouragers. So I would love to have that inner voice you have, but I don't have it yet. So I'm learning. I'm getting introduced to it. I'm developing it, I think. Like, I'm kind of talking off the top of my head, but like, I'm starting to notice there's another kind of voice that I can nurture in myself besides the should, need, you've got to, that voice. Because that voice in me has crippled me to the point of suicide. And the only thing that kept me alive was CPR. And that inner critic is absolutely fatal to me. So I get real, like, you know, and this really underscores for me how important type is. and why you emphasize that so much. Because
that's a great point.
I want to develop the voice you have, but I don't have that yet. It comes, you know, it still wants to come in as a critic, and it's starting to come in as a coach.
Yeah, and here's some suggestions, you know. It's like, for one of the things we found, that I found in my own head and working with others, you know, I call it the evil lawyer, you know, or the addict self. It's that part that doesn't want you to succeed. It's one, it's a part that wants you to say, fuck it, and just use, you know, and it's all not, you know, and that's, it's really powerful, and it knows you better than you know yourself. I mean, imagine you had one of these, you know, these world-class lawyers that can convince people that, you know, mass killers are just, you know, poor guys and should be let free. You know, they're so good. So they can, I mean, it can take anything. It can take your own weaknesses against you. You know, so one way that we can work with that is we can read really good literature. You know, feed the good dog. Like I'm working through this book now. I'm about 4/5 finished with, it's called Spark. It's a big book right now, and it's just talking about the multiple benefits of exercise.
It's a great book.
And it's completely orange. It's totally data-based. I mean, there's some anecdotal stuff he talked about. It's an MD, a doctor, talked about his patients. But he just reviews article after article after research, paper after paper that, you know, deals with the benefits of exercise for PTSD, for depression, for addiction, you know, for you name it. And it's just overwhelming, and it's like, you know, I really get it, but it keeps hitting you with the evidence. But it's very inspiring, too, and it's like, you know, this is what I've been talking about, and here's all the data to support it and all the research. So you can, you know, you read that, the book Mastery, that little old book that's part of the curriculum. It's just such a great book. It's so inspiring. And, you know, you can read books about, I mean, there's a book by David, great director, been a meditator for years, and he wrote a book called Getting the Big Fish, I think.
David Lynch.
Lynch, right. And it's just such a, that's exactly what I'm talking about. You know, and he talks about when he goes on a movie set, and one of his deals in his contract is he has a meditation room set up. So even if it's like a trailer or something, they'll have it all picked up for him so he can go and do his meditation every day. And he talks about how his ideas, his creativity, his life have been just absolutely transformed by his meditation. So, you know, you read stuff like that that inspires you, that feeds the good dog. And so when you start having, when the evil lawyer starts kicking your ass, you know, it's okay. You know, you're starting to get some healthy, inspiring vitamins, you know, and then you get the inner coach going, you know.
Yeah,
and,
it starts to, as I move towards more stuff like that. And what Hamlet said is really, really true and helpful to me, because when I did my treatment plan based on the four quadrants, then each day I do my tactical goals that meet those, that my practice. And, you know, having those goals, and I do them the night before. Just like you said, because if I let it go, then my mind will do all kinds of crazy stuff with it. So I'm finding it really helpful to write things down a day ahead of time, and, you know, be proud of myself when I accomplish it, as opposed to always putting myself down just because there's resistance. Even if I do it anyway, I'm still criticizing myself internally. I hear that voice. So, yeah, the meditation is really helping me witness more of that as opposed to getting enmeshed with it.
You know, and the author of the book, Spark, talking about, you know, addiction and exercise, he says, you know, the message you get when you do drugs is like, I'm a fucking loser. And when you work out and you finish a workout, you know, it's like, damn, I'm a winner. I did it again. You know, I'm feeling good.
Yeah.
You know, so it's just, we have to reinforce the positive. This phone call, is really inspiring me. Cause quite honestly, before I was, when I just got here, I was like, none of my internet stuff was working. I'm just feeling sorry for myself, feeling really tired. And this call has sparked me. I mean, it's like, yeah, and I did my meditation today, but I was going to blow off the workout because, I don't know, I deserve it someday. I'm just like, fuck no, man. It's going to make me feel better. And I know this from years, and it's just like you guys and you're, you know, this really intelligent conversation about how do we develop the inner coach? How do we deal with the negative messages? How, you know what I mean? It's really complex. And so it's probably support groups. you know, and you know, just lower left support for doing other practitioners, you know, who go through this stuff. And we all go through it, you know. So really good stuff. And I really appreciate the conversation.
I identified with whoever said about growing up in a family of discouragers. I mean, I grew up in a family of discouragers, like, all the way through. I was never patted on the back for anything. So I beat myself up a lot. I've done it my entire life. I still do it today. And I think one of the ways that I come around that I make myself feel better, you know, I'm a 7 too, and I'm sorry to say I didn't relate to whoever was speaking about being a 7, because I tend to thrive on a go fucking do it. This is what you need to do. You have to do it. You have no choice. Get the shit done. Let's go. Let's rock and roll. That, I tend to thrive on that inner talk. And one of the ways that I think I put down the bat and stop beating on myself is when I do those things that I'm supposed to do, because I know they make me feel better. You know, I mean, waking up at 4 o'clock in the morning isn't an easy chore. Some days I don't look forward to it, but once I sit, I feel better. It's a very comforting sort of inward space that I retreat to, which just fuels me. I find that it fuels me, you know, and say that I don't want to work out. I don't want to do this. I'm not going to enjoy this. My body hurts. I'm not going to, you know, like John was saying, once I do it and those endorphins are flooding my brain and I'm left with this space of, wow, I accomplished that. I did that. My day looks better. I'm able to handle whatever comes my way, you know, and I think that's one of the ways that I put the bat down and stop beating myself up is by accomplishing these little mountains that I kind of create for myself, you know, these tasks that I create where I'm going to wake up every morning at 4 and I'm going to sit and I'm going to work out every day and I'm going to do this and I'm going to do that and I'm going to accomplish this and I'm going to accomplish that. I put down the bat and it makes that inner basher that I have so loud, you know, kind of reduces it a little bit, you know?
You know, and one of the things I found, riffing off what you just said, Hamlet, is that when I don't want to meditate, I've learned, you know, over the years that it's usually because there's something my ego doesn't want to look at.
Yeah.
You know, or I don't want to feel. And I, you know, and I'll start meditating, boom, immediately, like, the pain will start coming up in my heart or my body. And it's like, okay, there's some real stuff I need to be with here. And, you know, I think Bill Harris said in his book early on, he said, you know, when the shit really starts hitting the fan in meditation, it's like just high five your partner or your angel, whoever it is next to you, and just say, hey, man, this is going to be very powerful when I get through it. You know, just the release and the understanding and the joy I'm going to feel when I work through this dark spot is going to be extraordinary. And the heavier it is, the bigger the victory when we get through it. So it's just, you know, knowing that over time and just like, with mindfulness, every time that we are able to feel a craving for drugs or, you know, whatever the behaviors are, or alcohol, and we just do it mindfully, okay, what am I feeling? My gut, you know, has this empty, annoying feeling, like, you know, there's a rat in there that's hungry and wants to get out, and my mind's saying, just say, fuck it, gotta do it, it's all bullshit, just do it, you know, it's okay. And mindfully, you say, oh, thank you, mind, for sharing, you know, and then you just stay with the feelings. And pretty soon it's like, oh, it's gone. And every time you go through one of those phases, that just reinforces the myelin sheath that, you know, over the neural pathways that are forming and not using. Because the old patterns are really, really deep, you know, because we've been feeding those things for years. So every time that we actually do it, even when the inner lawyer or the inner critic or whatever kicking our ass and we get it done, that's just preparing the foundation for the rest of our life. And you get to a certain point where it just becomes the go-to thing. I mean, it's what you do. So whether, you know, whatever state you're in, it's like it doesn't matter anymore because you're just trained and you just do your work because that's what you do. And that's what George Leonard, I think, would call master.
Yeah, that sounds really healthy.
Yeah, because, you know, the truth is we, you know, there's all kinds of states that arise, you know, and we have this fantasy about enlightenment, you know, we just sit around grinning and the light radiates off us. Well, yeah, you know, I've heard stories, but I never met anybody like that. So maybe it's true on some level, but I've never seen it. But, you know, while we do go through periods where we suffer, we feel bad, we go through periods of, you know, great happiness and bliss, and they just come and they go. And what we achieve in our practices in meditation is we become more identified over time with just the pure spaciousness that everything arises in. So no matter what's going on, part of you is completely free. And that really helped me when I was, you know, just so sick and in the emergency rooms and there, you know, all the stuff. The witness was there. You know, I could be, you know, totally, you know, feeling as sick as I'd ever been. But part of me was just like, you know, the awake part was there. And, you know, I came through it generally just really feeling blessed. And there was deep spiritual learning about, you know, letting go and about what really matters, what's important in my life, and just a lot of stuff. And because I was so helpless for a couple of weeks there, I really understood what it was like to grow old. You know, and so I could just be more present with my parents that I was working with, you know, and they're not able to do all the things they used to be able to do. So on a bunch of levels, it was just, it was a really beautiful thing. And that's, you know, because I practiced all these years. And in the emergency states, when times get rough, you know, you're going to be ready. You're going to be so much more capable than if you just neglected the work.
Yeah. That's great, John. I feel like it's what I like to call being more responsive instead of reactive to situations, you know. I find like I come home sometimes and I have 1,000 things to do and I'm just dead tired, like my body, and I'm stressed out. I'm able to just shift back and say, okay. Like situations that before would have just completely knocked me on balance. These are the types of situations growing up that my mom would be like, shut up, I've had a terrible day, I'm tired of this shit. I want everybody to go to their room, you know, and start throwing shit and like just lose it. You know, I don't lose it today. You know, I'm able to step back, you know, some really stressful, tired days, and I just have to do what I have to do because shit needs to get done. I'm able to just sort of navigate through those states with more ease, you know, and I think I owe that, for me, I think it's because of meditation, because of that posture, because of sitting, because of doing nothing, because of constantly taking a step back and being aware of not reacting, of doing nothing. And I think over time, done over and over again, you learn to sort of navigate through situations differently, you know?
Yeah, you know, and we're talking about types, you know, and Leslie Hershberger said one time in a class, you know, that you not only have your type, but you have your parents' types that you're filtered through. And my dad's a 1, the perfectionist. My mom's a 3, the achiever. And they were pretty darn good parents, you know, but I kind of almost unconsciously absorbed their structures, you know, like, and I had this feeling, you know, that I could never do enough and I could never be good enough. So I was just always ran around feeling totally inadequate. And I still go through that. It'll still come up. And there it is in my practice. Okay. You know, and I just go, God help me. You're right. I'm totally inadequate. So the only way I'm going to be able to do this is if, you know, if you support me and all this stuff. And, yeah, so those, it's, that's another thing about the meditation. And you're, the way you're talking, Victoria, you're really becoming aware of these negative voices and why they're there and what they're, you know, where you develop them. And I think the first step in really overcoming this stuff is being aware of it. Because if you're not aware of it, it's just unconsciously running you. So any questions or comments of what we've been talking about? If somebody wants to raise a new subject, that's all good, too.
Well, this is Heidi talking. I just wonder if you'd like to talk a little bit about what we should do when we get to that rat race feeling that Hamlet was mentioning at the beginning, when we just feel like we're doing our practices, but it's just a rat race without any real joy.
What is a rat race? Your life or practices are a rat race?
Whatever.
Yeah, go ahead, Hamlet.
Yeah, I think you weren't on the call yet, John. Or maybe you were, but
I was just saying how, you know, I get this feeling sometimes where, like, I'm always sort of looking for the next, either be it downtime or I can take a break, or the next obstacle that I have to overcome, or the next thing on my to-do list. Like, there's just always this urgency to do something. Like, I'm looking for like the carrot at the end of the stick. Like, I'm going to do all this and then I'm going to get my reward. I'm going to do all this and then I'm going to feel good. But in that process, how happy am I? Am I really enjoying it? Am I really enjoying this thing called recovery, this thing called life, this living process from day to day to day? How much time am I concerned with doing something to achieve a certain state versus just, you know, enjoying the process, you know, enjoying the plateau or whatever, you know? I think does that bring it home, Heidi?
Sorry, I muted myself. Yeah, I was, I just love to hear what people have to say about when you get in that kind of state. I'm sure everybody gets in that state.
Yeah, well, one thing about states is you don't make a philosophy out of it. You know, you don't make a, you know, make it the truth with a capital T. It's like you don't want to take your depression and, you know, and write the book about the nature of reality because you realize you're depressed. You know, and everything you say is going to be depressing. but an important thing to know about depression, this too will pass, okay? And that's why, you know, so many suicides could be prevented if there would just be somebody there, you know, an exterior ego at that point to say, hey, buddy, I know you're in hell right now and it feels like it's hopeless, but this is like flying through a cloud, you know, it's going to break through. And you don't want to, you know, you don't want to jump off the boat, you know, before you get to the harbor. So, but yeah, part of that is just, you know, how do you deal with states? You know, good ones, bad ones, indifferent ones, et cetera. They come and they go and they arise. And one of the things about the seven ego structure is called the ego planner. You know, always planning, you know, always the next thing and list. And, oh, my God, that can become just an
incredible burden. Well, we go to one under stress. That's like when you start talking from the sixth point of view about practice, I get freaked out, you know?
Oh, I know. I'm the fucking trooper, you know? That's what I do, you know?
You're my worst damn nightmare, you know?
I know. But
perfectionism is my state in disintegration. And what we have
I wouldn't say
where for you it's not.
Well, it's not perfectionism. It's just dogging.
It's not. No, it's not.
You suck it up and
filter.
Keep going, you know?
Yeah. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
I was a good wilderness guide. It was just hard and gruesome sometimes. You know, this pack and the heat and the cold and everything. And you just got to keep going. I'm a trooper. So, yeah, so that's definitely kind of my counterphobic six typology there. So, but one of the things about the seven is that, you know, that ego planning, you know, the next thing, the next thing, the next thing. And of course, just being present, taking time out and just focusing on your breath and say, okay, here I am, feeling your butt, you know, sitting on the seat or feeling your feet on the floor and just taking a moment to get off the, you know, the constantly planning the future mode is really helpful. And of course, the more we practice, the more we become aware when we get into that, you know. You can catch yourself before you lose, you know, 2 hours just tripping on it. And it doesn't mean that, you know, we never plan for the future. It's like I had a question, like a spiritual question the other day was like, can you read history and plan for the future and be present? It's a good question. What do you guys think? Yeah, that's what I said, right.
Of course.
In other words, the question, can you be reading a book on about history, really absorbed, and learning about the past, some past event or whatever it is, and can you be planning for the future and be present at the same time?
I think so.
Yeah, absolutely. And
doing
how
it.
Do you be... Yeah, you do it with awareness. I mean, the witness part, you realize this is you know, two of the things that make us really uniquely human is our ability to study history and understand, you know, our current state by what's gone before us with our ancestors and everything that went before us, and the ability to plan ahead for the future. And that's been an evolutionary necessity. Why? Because for some damn reason, it takes 18 to 30 years to raise a kid, you know? I mean, and, you know, probably a large part of human civilization culture has been shaped by the very fact that it just takes so many years for children to grow up and take care of themselves. And, you know, how do we survive as a species if we don't skillfully plan for our first, second grade, you know, housing? Oh, it's going to get cold this summer, so we have to have a house that's not only, you know, good in the heat, but it's good in the cold, and we have to have food, and we have to have all the necessities. So can, and that can get overwhelming, but can we be present at the same time and do these necessary things? And I think just like you guys were answering, yes, of course, but it takes work. And I'll shut up.
I love that.
And here's a little story for you guys. I guess I won't shut up. Because you don't want me, if you want me to shut up, you need to start talking. Because I'll keep talking.
We like to hear you talk, John.
Well, anyway, I'll give you a little supplement on this weekend. You know, we're doing all this integral recovery stuff. And so it was really tiring and hard and intellectual and blah, blah. But in the evenings, Bob and Guy and myself, and then I have a friend that would come over, who's my partner I play with, music with, and we would just start jamming. And man, I've never been so high and had so much fun playing music in my life. And I started playing music when I was 13 and I'm 58. It was just ecstatic. And what started, you know, the whole was greater than the sum of its parts. I mean, we hit a level of just being played and playing off of each other that was truly ecstatic. And, you know, the morning we were getting ready to leave, you know, we're the music's over and guys says, can we play Hey Joe just one more time? You know, we go in there and we just have this like 8 minute just ecstatic playing together. And I'll say this, maybe this is a good thing to talk about Sevens. It's, you know, for the last 4 years, I've just been a dedicated practitioner as far as learning electric blues guitar. And man, then finally, you know, when you get to that point where all those hours of sitting there learning licks and learning, scales and, you know, all the myriad of stuff that goes on, put it together, and then you just get going. And they said, dude, you were channeling Hendrix. And it felt like I was channeling Hendrix. You know, I was just playing at a level that it just was astounding.
Yeah.
And it wasn't dumb luck, you know. It was because I put in the time and put in the hours. And then you get those moments and go, well, shit, you know. Of course, thank you. And even just the capacity to find the discipline, to find the voice, to find the place that allows you to practice. It's just grace, you know. It's dumb luck. I don't think I could have manufactured it myself. You know, I do the best I can, and then the universe seems to meet me more than halfway to pull me the rest of the way. So, anyway, it was really extraordinary.
And you really, for me, make a great point about, I know one of my biggest challenges that I've been working with is that instant gratification thing, and you know, really looking at my own cost benefit thinking and a lot of short term benefit stuff is, you know, sort of the addiction of my type. And just the way you said that and remembering why I'm doing what I'm doing and what the payoff is of going deeply into something, because I've had that experience, you know, going into the whole five space of deeply entering something and doing the hard work to get to that place you're talking about where you're just flying. You said, you used the term, I was being played. You know, I feel like that sometimes when I'm running, it's like I'm being run.
Absolutely.
I'm being thought. I'm being walked. I'm being prayed, you know. It's like it's just an amazing sensation of flow, and I'm reminded that it doesn't come without a price, you know, in for me, insofar as overcoming that, well, it doesn't feel good right now, and I want to feel good right now, and you know, that unhealthy seven stuff that wants it right now, wants it good, wants it happy, wants it to feel terrific.
Yeah.
I mean, I have to watch the perfectionism on the one side. So I can bounce back and forth between child, indulgent child, and perfectionist whip wielder. So there's like
you know,
a ground that comes from doing the small stuff every day consistently.
And another really good anchor, I think, is that when we begin to find the purpose and meaning behind it, why we're alive, you know, what our individual goal is, what our individual, I'm not goal, but maybe vocation, you know, what is
yeah.
that, what is calling us to show up in the world and what gifts are we here individually to do? And when we begin to, you know, make that part of the foundation of the structure of our life and our practice and what we do, that will often get us through the, you know, the weak times, or we're having a bad day and we're getting beat up by the critic or whatever the hell it is, you know, and then you go, well, you know, and in my case, I said, well, I'm John, you're a teacher, goddammit, you're teaching this stuff. I
yeah.
can't tell you how many times that has come, that has gotten me through these things when I just want to give up and throw up my hands, you know. I said, well, what would you tell your students? And the answer is fucking obvious to me, you know, because I tell them all the time. And that has been one of the things that's helped me, you know, stick with it. And, you know, and we're not perfect. And if you do fall off the wagon, well, you know, it's like the Rumi poem, you know, about the caravan. It says, you know, we're not a caravan of despair. And though you've broken your vows 1,000 times, you know, come. A constant invitation to be the best part of ourselves and realize that, you know, we're not perfect. And perfect people freak me out because I'm so imperfect, you know. And my counter transference when I have a one client, it's like, holy shit, they're perfectionists. I have no chance. And then I figure out, oh, all that stuff is beating up on themselves, so they don't have time for you. And I kind of breathe a sigh of relief, you know. So, you know, just realize there's a certain beauty and humility and glory in our imperfection. And, you know, just dust yourself off. Roger Wall says spiritual progress happens one body length at a time. You know, it's just part. We fall on our face. We get up, dust ourselves up, and keep going. Fall on our face again. And just keep going, and there it is. So look, you guys, I got a client right now. I got
all
a
right.
Open. Thank you.
Thanks, everybody.
Tired.
I really appreciate it.
Looking forward to this. Mm-hmm. Really, really
thank
cool.
Thank you.
Appreciate you guys. God bless.
See ya.
Bye-bye.
See you all Friday. Bye.